This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have with me Dave Obey, the longest-serving congressman in the history of the state of Wisconsin, who retired just a couple years ago. He's the author of a really interesting memoir called Raising Hell for Justice, The Washington Battles of a Heartland Progressive. Dave Obey, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you much. Happy to be here.
It's great to see you. We're here in Madison, Wisconsin, and uppermost on people's minds is the recall of Scott Walker. And who will run against him? Your name's been mentioned frequently. Are you going to run?
Well, first of all, let me simply say I think that what has happened in this state is incredibly sad. I come from an era, I served in the legislature in the Precambrian era when dinosaurs still roamed the land. And we had personal friendships across the aisle, and we would fight like hell from 9 in the morning till 5 at night. Then we'd go over to the Congress bar, Democrats and Republicans alike. Republicans would sit at one table. Democrats would sit at another table. And once in a while, we'd buy each other a drink. The reporters, George Armour from the Milwaukee Journal, Aldrich Revell from the Capital Times, Lou Roberts from the State Journal, they would sit at the bar with their typewriters, typing their stories. And if they had a question, they'd come over and ask us. And then they'd hand their copy to the copy boys. They'd run it down Carroll Street, and that's the way business was done. We were opponents, but not adversaries, or at least we were adversaries, but not enemies is a better way to put it. And so it's not a happy time for the state because state politics has almost become a snake pit. And I think the governor, while he doesn't bear exclusive responsibility for that, he certainly bears a lot of responsibility. In terms of my own desire to run, I don't really want to run. I've told people from the start that even if I were to consider it, I would only consider filling out the governor's term and would not in any way even think of running for re-election. But I've made quite clear that my preference by far is to have Herb Kohl run. I think anybody with an ounce of observation ability knows that Herb Kohl is the most popular political practitioner in the state. My other choice in terms of who would make the best candidate would be Tom Barrett from Milwaukee. He's got a sense of balance. He's got guts. He has independence. And I think he would bring the civility back to Madison that we so desperately need.
Herb Kohl wasn't involved really in the uprising here, the fight back here anyway. Do you think that's a disadvantage for him? I know some of the protesters probably would say, Herb Kohl, where was he when we needed him?
No, I think anybody who knows Herb knows where his sentiments were on that. But I think Herb would bring a healing atmosphere to this town, and I think that's very important. I also think that with his business background, it would be very hard to demagogue him as being somebody who doesn't know how to deal with the business community. Tom Barrett, I think would be a great governor just because of his personal qualities. Tom is often criticized for being too nice. I mean, that you can't be too nice in politics, provided that you also have a tough edge, which he has. But I think in terms of staying power as a candidate, those are our two best shots.
What about Kathleen Falk? She's a former Dane County executive. She's fast out of the gate. She seems to have some of the unions and some of the Democratic Party establishment behind her. How do you evaluate her chances?
I think she's a fine person, but I stand by my judgment that Kohl or Barrett would be the strongest candidates.
Why do you think Walker right now, according to a recent poll, has 51% approval and would beat anyone whose name is out there other than Herb Kohl?
Well, all I can say about that poll is I certainly haven't met the 51% that the poll claims are for Walker. I have never seen such depths of anger and frustration on the part of so many people. I've been in over 20 counties in this state, north, south, east, and west, and I just find people immensely disappointed in the governor because he was elected at a time when they were looking for cooperation and teamwork, and instead they got an architect of massive confrontation, the likes of which we haven't seen in Wisconsin in my lifetime.
Yeah, what do you make of his all-out assault on public sector union organizing and collective bargaining?
I think it is just ideology front and center, and I think it's a political power play. I think he's determined to weaken politically any organizations that he can that represent people who he thinks are not likely to vote for his party. And I think in terms of national attention, the defining issue has been workers' rights, workers' bargaining rights. But the issue that sticks in my craw even more, there are two of them. First of all, what the governor is trying to do to the state by way of voter ID. He pretends that he is taking these actions in order to protect the integrity of the voting process. There has been far more fraud in the way he has presented that issue than we've ever seen at the ballot box. And what he's done in practical, when you get beyond the theoretical to the practical world, which is where most people live, he is making it much more difficult for senior citizens, for college students, lower income people to actually have their vote counted because not everybody in the state has a picture ID. Not everybody in the state has a driver's license, and so I think it's just a fancied up way to hide what he's really trying to do to weaken political opposition. My second, and when you start messing around with people's right to vote, you are going right to the guts of our democratic system. And that to me is not only recallable, it ought to be impeachable. My second bone to pick with him is that he has helped bring this snake pit mentality to the state capitol, and I think we desperately need somebody who sees politics in a different light.
And he's been bad on almost every issue you could name on top of those two, like the environment and the social safety net and things.
Well, I agree with that, but I mean, I don't think that's enough to justify recall. To me, I don't like the recall process like a lot of other people. I would prefer that people get elected and they serve out their full term. But when those same people abuse the privilege of their office to such an extent, and when they then mislead the public about their intentions, then I think they've crossed the line, especially when they start messing with people's basic right to vote.
I'm speaking with Dave Obey. He's the longest-serving congressman in the history of Wisconsin. Was a legislator in Wisconsin before he went to Washington, D.C. He's the author of a great memoir that I highly recommend called Raising Hell for Justice, The Washington Battles of a Heartland Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio, and I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, founded by Robert La Follette, one of Dave Obey's heroes and mine, back in 1909. Tell me, what would be the impact if Walker were to prevail in this recall election?
Well, I think it would demoralize the progressive forces in the state. And I think it would, add to the general sense of detachment, and the general sense of disappointment about politics as a whole. I just think that I know there are people who think that almost anybody can beat Governor Walker, and I would suggest that simply is not the case. This is going to be an uphill fight. Because the governor will try to take advantage of people's basic determination to be guided by goodwill, and he will try to take advantage of that and turn people's concern about the recall process into an endorsement of Walker and his programs, and that would be a real corruption of what this has all been about.
I'm waiting for that advertisement, and he's going to have a ton more money to throw into ads.
Well, I mean, he ought to have a ton of money from his right-wing money boys, because he's been their local water boy on all of these issues. So they're trying to protect their investment by everybody from the Koch brothers on down. That's what the name of the game is.
If we could switch gears and talk about national politics for a little bit. You served in Congress. You were there before Newt Gingrich got there. You outlasted him there. In your book, Raising Hell for Justice, you wrote that Gingrich was totally without redeeming social value, a political sociopath whose venality matched that of Joe McCarthy. Also, you said he was a man of monumental, self-centered immaturity. Tell us how you really feel about him.
Well, it's too bad, because he is a very able person. He is one of the brightest people I've ever known and one of the most imaginative. The problem is that very often that imagination turns into fantasy land. And he has this tendency when he wants to defeat somebody politically, he has this tendency to attack their patriotism, to attack their sense of Americanism. He did more, in my judgment, than anybody except Joe McCarthy in my lifetime to denigrate the political dialogue and to degrade it. I mean, when he came to the Congress in 1978, he started running classes to teach people how to tear down their opponent personally, not just politically. And, I mean, they published bulletins, How to Talk Like Newt. And they urge people to use words like festering, decay, sick, all of these negatively charged words or phrases, in order to try to undermine the political opposition. And that to me borders on McCarthyism, and it certainly doesn't do the Democratic system any good.
You know, it's interesting, Dave Obey, you mentioned that he attacks people's Americanism. After he won the South Carolina primary, he started to do that exact same thing with Barack Obama. He said the campaign in November is going to be between those who believe in Americanism, American exceptionalism, and American values versus Saul Alinsky, Barack Obama, and bureaucratic European socialism.
Well, with all due respect to Newt, I don't think people are much interested in his analysis of Saul Alinsky's role in the history of the United States. I think they're much more interested in what Gingrich or Romney or the President Obama will do in order to try to make a difference in people's lives and put this economy back together long term.
What would a Gingrich presidency be like?
Chaotic. It would bring the sweetness and charm of the political system in Madison right now to the nation in spades, and it would be a tumultuous time, and I think an incredibly divisive time.
What do you make of Romney?
I personally pray every day that Romney's candidacy survives, because I think he is the weakest of the Republicans that Obama could run against. I think Romney personifies the noblesse oblige attitude of the top 1%, the economic elite in this country, who have no real appreciation for what the lives of average Americans are like, who think as someone said, who thinks that they've been born on third base and think that they hit a triple. He is clueless in terms of the impact of the policies that he proposes on average working people, and I think that Newt Gingrich has in his campaign exposed that about Romney.
You know, the conventional wisdom among national Democratic Party people and the Obama people is that it would be easier to run against Gingrich than it would be Romney, but you don't think so?
I have been trying, since I chaired the Joint Economic Committee during the Reagan administration, I've been trying to get people to understand what is happening with wealth and income in this country. And I've been trying to get people to understand that we've had a huge gap developing between the very most well-off 1% and everybody else. And it has taken until now for that issue to finally be driven home. And I think what's driven it home is the Romney candidacy, where his idea of capitalism apparently is no regulation on anybody about anything. And Gingrich seems to have the same attitude. What people forget is that the purpose of government regulation in the economic sector, for instance, isn't to penalize the business community. It's to keep the actions of people in business fair, so that other businessmen aren't disadvantaged by the corner cutting that some people take in the society. The purpose of regulation is to protect not just workers but investors as well. And the last time I looked, I thought that the Republicans prided themselves on being defenders of investors. Well, you aren't helping the investing class if you allow the economic marauders in this society to get away with murder at the expense of legitimate businesses.
What do you make of the Occupy Wall Street, We Are the 99% movement that is focused on that wealth issue that you raise?
I think they helped to catalyze and crystallize that issue. And I think they helped drive home what the economic facts of life were in terms of economic fairness. So I think they played a key role. There have been some cases of unfortunate breakout of violence here and there, but that's been held to a very small minimum. And I think they've helped make clear that most of the country is mad as hell and they don't want to take it anymore.
Dave, will we explain in a little more detail why this wealth gap is so corrosive?
Well, I mean, the people make up this false debate between Keynesian economics and what they call the Austrian field of economics, Hayek. And the conservatives make Hayek their darling, and they say that Hayek has demonstrated that market forces alone should determine what happens in an economy. Well, that's misinterpreting what Hayek himself said. Hayek wanted us to rely principally on market forces, but he assumed that there would be a strong social safety net underneath every American family to start out, or every family starting out, and he included in that a decent safety net with respect to health care and education. And the problem is that if you have had a 30-year period in which the wealth and the economic power of the top 1% has steadily increased while everyone else has been just treading water, sooner or later, average families lose the ability to own their home. They lose the ability to send their kid to college. They lose the ability to have the car fixed when it won't start on a Thursday morning and you're already late for work. And people lose faith in the legitimacy of the system, especially when they see that some people in this top 1% are sitting there paying half the tax rate that some working class person is paying, and that destroys confidence in the economic system and the political system, and it's not the way America, I think, wants to be seen, and it certainly isn't what Wisconsin politics has stood for the last century.
I'm speaking with Dave Obey, the longest-serving congressman in the history of Wisconsin. He retired a couple years ago. He's got a memoir out called Raising Hell for Justice, The Washington Battles of a Heartland Progressive. And in that book, you make a vigorous defense of the role of government. You say it's to keep the big boys honest and protect the weak from being bullied and bloodied. Love that line. You also say that the right wing in this country detests the very idea of government or relying on government. Why do you think they so detest government?
Well, I mean, if you look at the history of the country, up until FDR, the federal government was used primarily to help finance the westward expansion of this country and to help business do business all across the country. When the Great Depression hit and FDR came to power, he tried to widen that deal by including actions that would help average middle-income families. And so you had policies followed with Social Security, with unemployment compensation, with progressive income tax, you name it, all of those items, that helped to expand the share of our economic prosperity that was experienced by average people. And that meant that people at the very top of the ladder were getting somewhat less than they were before as a share of national income. And a lot of them didn't like that. So they regarded FDR as a traitor to his class. And FDR's response was, like hell I am, we're simply just trying to save capitalism. And what has happened since then is that the right wing, especially a number of these very wealthy families, they've organized these right wing think tanks, everything from the Heritage Foundation to the Bradley Foundation to the Scafee Foundation to the Koch brothers, you name it. And they pumped a lot of money into these so-called academic think tanks to try to build a case for dismantling what FDR did and what everybody has done since then to try to civilize the American economic system. And they finally reached a critical mass. When Eisenhower was elected president, they thought, well, here's our chance. Now we can repeal the no deal. Eisenhower said, no way, baby. These are settled questions and wouldn't have any part of it. But now they think that with the election of a majority in the House of Representatives that they have a chance to really go after a lot of what Roosevelt built and return to an Ayn Rand, every man for himself mentality. And I don't think the American people are going to stand for that.
I wonder what they'd do if, you know, the American people started to rebel like they were in the 30s, then they'd be back in that exact same situation. But they're in this grab-it-all-now kind of mode.
Absolutely.
What do you make of President Obama?
I cannot think of any president who came to town with the deck more stacked against him than Obama has. I mean, from the day he walked into the White House, the political opposition has made quite clear that they will do virtually anything to defeat him and deny him a second term. I mean, when we tried to deal with the much maligned stimulus package in order to try to prevent job growth. And incidentally, people get confused. When you talk about stimulus package, a lot of people think you're talking about the corporate bailouts. That was an entirely separate issue. We were simply trying to prime the pump economically to expand the purchasing power of average Americans so they could buy goods and services that kept people employed. And when I had my very first meeting with the Republican leadership on the committee to try to see what they would be willing to support and what they wouldn't, I told them, I said, look, we'd like to build a bipartisan approach on this. Tell me what you'd like to see in the bill and what you'd like not to see in the bill. And the response I got back was, I'm sorry, Dave, but we've got orders from headquarters. We can't play. In other words, they were going to kick the hell out of whatever it was that we produced, and they did. They tried to obstruct everything, and they've been going at it ever since. And I'm amazed at Obama's patience. I'm amazed at his personal tolerance, and I'm happy that in the last 6 months he has finally made it clear that he understands that these guys aren't going to compromise with him in any meaningful way, that they're out to deny him a second term. Mitch McConnell as much as admitted that when he said his number one goal was to defeat Obama. And so I think he's put on the boxing gloves just like Harry Truman did, not because he wanted to, but because he was given no other choice.
It took him a while, though.
Yes, it did.
In your book, you write about other presidents that you've served with. You make a point to say you didn't serve under them because they're co-equal branches. You have an account of you're seeing Reagan in 1982 or 1983, and even then he seemed totally out of it. Do you think he was suffering from Alzheimer's that early?
I have no way of knowing. All I know is that the Reagan who I saw in those meetings was not very with it. He was an extremely nice man and a charming man, but I always wondered who was really running the show.
Who was, do you think?
Oh, I think he had a lot of pros around him, people like Jim Baker, people like that. Baker was a very talented person, and I think people like that were largely minding the store.
Dave Obey, I was interested in your account of George W., too, who you talk about in your book, Raising Hell for Justice, that you went in shortly after 9/11 with some Homeland Security proposals, and he seemed also totally to be ill-informed, under-informed. You called him a security risk.
Well, we had a bipartisan—I mean, Bill Young, who was the Republican chairman of the Appropriations Committee, and I spent days talking with all of our security agencies, trying to see what they needed after 9/11. We went down to the White House, told the president that whatever he didn't want, we would throw out immediately. We just thought that we needed some additional actions taken on the Homeland Security front. And he basically stiffed us and said, no, if you add $1 to our budget request on this, I'll veto the bill. No, you know, I've got time for a few comments and I'm out of here. It was a very uninformed and I thought needlessly confrontational moment.
Sounds just pro forma, perfunctory meeting. You said he's the worst president you served with, including Richard Nixon.
Yeah, I think he was. I mean, all he did was get us into two wars on the basis of misinformation and take us from 4 years of budget surpluses to huge deficits. So I thought he was the worst president. I thought the best president I served with was Jerry Ford.
Yeah, I was interested to hear that.
And in my book, I tell a story about Jerry coming to the House floor just shortly before he died. And I went up to him. I said, Jerry, you're going to be surprised, but I've got a chapter on presidents I've served with, and I've ranked you as the best. And he put his hand on my shoulder and grinned, and he said, damn slim pickings, wasn't it?
That is a great line. We have less than a minute left. Could you talk about briefly this political figure from Wisconsin fighting Bob La Follette and why you like him so much?
Well,
he didn't serve under him, obviously.
Because until Bob La Follette came to power, Wisconsin government was owned lock, stock, and barrel by the big boys, by the timber companies, the railroads, the insurance companies, the mining companies. And La Follette turned government right side up and tried to put the public interest at the top of his priority list. And working with the University of Wisconsin and his political allies, they fashioned a program that tried to respond to the needs of average people. And he just never forgot that the big boys can take care of themselves. It's the average people walking around on Main Street who need some help.
Yeah, that's a lesson that we need to keep learning today. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Dave Obey has been my guest. Longest-serving congressman in the history of Wisconsin, author of Raising Hell for Justice. Thanks so much for being with me today.
You bet.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.